Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis. And the music is awful loud today, and I don't know why, but anyhow, it's about to stop. And I am getting a chance to have my very first, and I mean, when I say very first, I mean my very first conversation with Renee Jaworski. And so we're doing this as a performance piece. I got an email a while ago, a few weeks ago, it's right now, it's in January of 2019. And this email said what, Renee?
This said that I am writing a book about Peter Tork, who's, you know, the internationally famous former Monkees musician, and among many other things, many other things. That was only for, you know, a very small percentage of his life. But I had come across the 1979. We're not going to call it an interview. It was a spontaneous, you know, conversation. That you did in Santa Monica with him. And I felt that it was so important to learn about what happened behind the scenes for that, how you met him, what you felt was going on with him. I had to reach out to you because that interview is very famous. A lot of people have interacted with it, watched it over the years since it was posted online. I guess it was lost or... Four decades.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just incredible that it was found, it was put online, and stars, you know, converged, you know. And I said, you know, can I talk to you? And your response was, you know what? Let's do another reasonably spontaneous conversation about the reasonably spontaneous conversation. And I said, I probably... I'll be honest with you, Dennis, I might have screamed for about 3 minutes straight. I was squealing and screaming and running around my house. I said, not only am I going to get some answers, but I'm going to talk to Dennis Tardon. And everybody who knows me knows that I had spent weeks running around talking about Dennis Tardon. And the reason, I'll tell you why, it was such a unique encounter. And for somebody who's a biographer, looking at tapes and tapes of my subject, you know, Peter Tork, you know, talking, and it's always the same three questions. It's always the same four, you know, oh, how did you, you know, tell me about how you got in the Monkees. It's over and over and over. And all of a sudden, it's the opposite of that. It's the antithesis of that. And I'm just like, I mean, when I came across that, I stayed up like half the night and I watched that interview. It's not an interview, but that conversation, it's almost a half an hour long. And I just kept hitting replay. Replay. I said, what is going on? I was reading the comments and everybody had, you know, intense reactions to this encounter that you had with Peter Tork. And I said, I have, you know, it didn't even occur to me, Dennis, that I could contact you. That was a while later that I said, you know, I was contacting everyone else and I said, wait a minute, let me look up Dennis. And I look him up and here you are, you're still doing this. You theoretically could talk to me. I don't know if you wanted to talk to me, but I said, oh my gosh. And I freaked out and I'm still freaking out. So that's the email. That's the very, very long response to the question about what the email was.
That is, thank you for the background. And I love how you, as a storyteller, you give wonderful background and you go ahead and you connect and you, the storyline of how it goes through. All right, so I have so many questions. That's why, as anyone who's listening to this will understand and see the parenthetical at the top of this, the first conversation.
Yes, I love that.
Jaworski, because I knew that we had many things to talk about and many synchronicities and cross points in our consciousnesses of what we're doing. So, all right, I'm going to pick just one. Why Peter?
I love that question.
What got you interested?
I've been asking myself that, and as you know, from your own conversation plural or singular with him, that you've had with him, you know that this is a community, socially based person. And so
yeah.
there's no way that I, as an individual, can make the decision to do this. And what I mean is, it's a very practical thing. I'm not trying to be mystical or something. The world wants many biographies of Peter Tork. The world is clamoring for them. The world is pushing for them. He has so many fans who don't even speak English. He has fans in remote areas of the world. He has fans who are 9 years old today, and he has fans who are 90 years old today. And the fact that he unfortunately left this realm about 1 year ago, very important and sad, but he's continuing on in a way that I did not expect. So the answer to that question is I was propelled into this. I am not a typical fan. I am not the best person to write. I am not the best person to write his biography, but I'm assuming there's going to be many biographies as time goes on. I just am the person who is kind of just doing it first, and I've been told by people just keep saying, someone's got to do it, someone's got to do it, you know, and really watching that conversation with you and him, I just, probably it was like that week that I said, you know what, I could do it. I wanted to read his biography. The best works of art come because you want to explore it and experience it, and you can't find it, and there's a void. And so then somebody says, "Why don't you do it? Why don't you do it?" And I said, "Okay, I'm going to go buy his. I'm going to buy his biography so I can read it because he's so interesting." I'm not a typical fan. There are fans of his who could tell you what date he wore which shirt. They can tell you which bar he played at. I'm not that guy, and I'm not going to write the book that way. And in fact, I'm not writing the book that way. I'm writing the book from a fictional, everything is accurate, but I'm writing it more of like, you know, Truman Capote in Cold Blood, which is more of like, this stuff really happened, but it's interesting, and it doesn't have to be chronological. Yeah. Peter was an iconoclast in so many ways. I don't think he would want to read a book that's like, Peter Tork's, you know, grandfather was born in, you know, we're not doing that. I'm writing a book that people will want to read, and people who are not monkey fans, people who are not rock and roll fans, people who, you know, I want to make it engaging the way he was engaging. And he was, he went across so many, I mean, the blues world, the rock world, the folk world, you know, I want this to like reach everybody. So I don't know the answer to your question, Dennis, but I've been asking myself daily, but I'm not the best person for the job, but I'm the person that got the job. So I'm going to keep doing it because it's great, you know, it's great.
Yeah. Well, Harry Truman said the same thing.
Oh, really?
Yep. When they came over and knocked on Blair House or wherever he was at the vice president and said, you're the president of the United States now. And when FDR died. And he said, well, I am not the best person for the job, but I'm the one that's got it.
Okay, okay. You know, that sounds a little familiar now. It's coming back. Okay, that's right. Well, it's sometimes you're just there. Sometimes you're just put in that position, and it's up to you whether you take the baton and run with it or you don't. And I'm choosing
that's
to do
wonderful.
It. That's
wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, let's put each other chronologically on the planet, on the timeline at this time. I am 71 years old this year, born in 1948. You are?
I am 38, so I'm 1 year older than Peter when he did your broadcast, the initial broadcast.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right, and you are based in physically based in Syracuse, New York. I'm physically based in Austin, Texas, right now. Even though nodally, we are connected to the world. It just happens to be where our bodies are anchored
that's
at this
where
moment.
I am today. Yeah, that's where I am.
We're right. And so you into this realm, and the thing that I find that I found fascinating, one of the things that Peter and I talked about, and you have to understand, let me in 1979, Dennis at 30 years old, at that time, I mean, 31 years old, I was smoking a lot of dope. So both of us were still in our, and so there's a kind of a historical fog as to exactly how I connected with him, but I did.
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely. Anything. All subjects are open.
Excellent, Dennis. I love your attitude so much. Okay, so this is something I've been wrestling with for a while, and even just crafting this book, and then I'm also working on another series, but that's a different thing. But what does dope mean in the context of the 60s and 70s? Because if you ask 100 people, you get 100 different answers. So in your case,
thank you.
And you're saying that you're connecting with Peter, what was it
right.
precisely?
Now, we did not talk specifically about which drugs, but mine was marijuana.
Okay.
So that was my my into consciousness. I would always I would find that it allowed me to get past. I grew up being extremely having this critical voice inside my head. You know, I was just really, really, as a matter of fact, it's been part of the arc of my entire life. And so what this did was it seemed to distract that critical voice enough to where suddenly all the ideas that were sitting there on the other side of this, you know, I thought of that critical voice. I thought of him first as a him. And I thought of him as a like a closed down this pipe, and that when I would smoke, suddenly I would distract that critical voice, and it would open, and suddenly all the ideas that were just waiting there on the other side would come through. And I love that. And then that was my path with marijuana. Now it is. And so it allowed me to have a greater compassion for myself. And when I had a greater compassion for myself, suddenly my critical voice went down. And that was what dope meant and what I used it for during that time.
And were you high during that conversation?
Well, I don't know how. I did not smoke right before I did, but I'm sure I did the night before. So.
Okay.
However long it would take, I probably smoked every single day or virtually every single day from 1975 until 1982 or 3. And then I took little breaks and stuff until I stopped smoking pot around 1991,
came to it late because most people are getting introduced to this in their adolescence or late teens.
Absolutely.
You're coming to it
Absolutely.
Late. It's almost from an intellectual. You're coming to it from an intellectual, not an immaturity standpoint, which is really unique.
Right. I'm really grateful that I didn't, because I wouldn't. It helped me. It helped me to come to it late. And I grew up in South Texas. And in South Texas, there was so little information. Like, for example, I do a comedy routine on this, but it's true. I thought I had invented masturbation. Nobody had told me. I went, wow. And so, you know, I mean, that's the kind of information, even though I grew up in an upper middle class South Texas, the children were not talked to or really let in on things. So we thought that marijuana was heroin, was like you injected it. Didn't even know it smoked it or whatever. And it wasn't until after I'd been in the Army And one sergeant got me high one time. It was the first time I had, and it wasn't. Then I got out of the Army and went into the into journalism at the University of Houston, and then got out of it. And that was when we discovered my wife then discovered marijuana. And I took it very much. I mean, it was so interesting, Renee, because when I would get high, the first thing I would think of was, oh God, it was like the spiritual. And I used the equation, God is love. If you use that equation being the equal sign. So that you and if we know what an equation is, and we know in the laws that you can substitute if the equal means it with the same as. So I would it would connect me to whatever that universal force of whatever love was. I connected with it. That would be that first rush would connect me to that place. Thank you for letting me talk about this. Very seldom talked about it, and I haven't talked about it on this. But it is important for me to hear myself talk about it, so I know whether or not I have dug deeply enough into it.
Well, I have a follow-up question, Dennis, because I'm wondering where you. First of all, I think the love that you're experiencing from this is connected to stifling the voice of criticism. So you're being criticized, and now that voice is being kind of silenced. So you're finally allowing yourself, or you're finally experiencing love because there's no negative voice bringing you down. But then again, what is it that's happening in your life at that time? Now, you said love, and you said it's your wife at the time. Of course, you love her at the time. So you're almost being given this by a person that you love and trust. And then it's silencing this voice. I could easily see how it's like just curling up under a warm blanket. You know, you're getting it from someone you trust and doing it with someone you love and trust. And then suddenly you feel like better about yourself. So I think it all dovetails. I think it all goes together.
It does. It does. And what is really interesting, and one of the things that I want to share with you, and I'm not quite ready to share this with the world, but I will share it with you, is that I actually had Diana on one of the episodes of Reasonably Spontaneous Conversation, and we just found it.
Oh,
so
really?
You're going to be able to see her.
Wow.
And us talking about our relationship in the same way. And you want to think that's weird? I mean, go back to your 14-year-old boyfriend.
That is really weird. How did
I know? I know.
Are you going to post it on YouTube, or how can I?
I'm
going
to post it to you. I'll send it to you. I'll send it to you and tease it to anyone else. And after we think about it and talk about it and go about it, we can because it is weird. And it was during that time. It was the post pill pre AIDS. That little window.
That little window of
sexual freedom when the entire world, we'd gone through the 60s, so we went through the free love and what that was and what that meant, and got more into the actual mainstream. And then there was this, so there was just this time. And my wife and I had based our marriage on a book. As we both fell in love with it. It was a Robert Heinlein called Stranger in a Strange Land.
I know the book.
Are you familiar with it?
I'm familiar with it, from many years ago.
Exactly. Yes. Many years ago. And so there was this concept of Water Brothers, and there was a concept of what is marriage, and that a marriage, these big plural marriages and what they are. So that'll be the background as you watch this interview.
Have you heard the song Triad?
No. Tell me about it.
Okay, That is a Google search for you. That's your homework for tonight, Dennis. It's loosely based on that. It's called Triad. It was covered by, I'm blanking on their name, but I know they're very famous. Jefferson Airplane covered it, but it was written by David Crosby for the Byrds. And they kicked them out of the band in part because of it, because they said this is too crazy even for us. And Dennis, you are more connected to Peter Tork than you even know, because David Crosby's song Triad, which is I Love You, I Love You Too, Why Can't We Go On As Three, okay,
yeah.
That is about a plural relationship he had with Peter's soon-to-be wife and mother of his first child. And, David Crosby's experience with her. Her name is Ren Stewart. And he wrote that song, and it was also informed by that book that you mentioned. And so David Crosby was living that book with somebody who ends up going on and having a child with Peter Tork. So you and Peter Tork were both influenced by that book at that very time you were talking. But look up the song, and he gets kicked out of the Byrds in part because of it. Till today, people still talk about it. David says no, it was other things. Everyone else says no. But, Roger McGuinn was like just freaked out because he said, even later in his life, Roger McGuinn, he says, it's not just that David wrote a song about that. It's that he was doing that. He said he was doing that. And for some reason, these people were like hippie, they're hippie, free love people. But for them, it was like this crossed some kind of a line. And I'm reading Graham Nash's memoir right now, and he's freaked out by David Crosby's polyamorous ways. Even Graham Nash is like, dude, like it's too much. So I'm really amazed because, Dennis, you present yourself in that conversation. Truly, I would have felt you were very straight-laced. I mean, you're defending communism. You're dressed perfectly. Yep. Your hair is not down to your shoulders.
No. Defending capitalism.
Defending capitalism,
right?
What did you say?
Defending capitalism.
You just seemed very, straight-laced. And now I'm finding out so many other things to the contrary. And I will remind you later if I don't do it now. But I will tell you, you and Peter Tork are divergent, and I can't believe it.
Yeah.
You guys are you're the letter X, because he presents himself so much on this, like, hippie scale. But really, I'm finding out the more I dig into his life, he had a very not controversial life. He's actually I don't know how to say this. It's a positive thing I'm saying about him. There's no skeletons in his closet, really. He's actually kind of squeaky clean.
Yeah.
Dennis Tardon, you are somebody who's very interesting because the more I'm peeling back these layers, that you're peeling them for me, I'm saying, I don't know Dennis Tardon at all. Wow.
Well, you're going to be one of the first to see this interview before we put it up online, because I just wanted to, and it's weird, and it's one of those things of it. There is a reason why surgeons don't operate on their own children. There's a reason why interviewers should be careful about interviewing. Because I could not come off as Poncier. I mean, I really am so full of it in this interview. It was one of the – she does a wonderful job. But I was very much in a performance mode of, aren't I just this ultra – I'm at the leading. It's so funny. It's hilarious. So I can't wait for you to see it. But I want to ask you, one of the things about this interview with Peter Tork that I want in these last couple of minutes, I want to say is that it's so fascinating that, because this is an Icarus experience, how many people fly that close to the sun? I mean, here's a man, they outsold the Beatles one year.
Yeah.
And then to have that experience, to have to have go through that experience, I read about it in Sally Field's autobiography that she read. I love it when people do their, read their own autobiographies. But anyway, but she was talking about him and some of the times that they were together as they were going during the short stories. But anyway, but the point is that he had that experience. Then he had to come back to Earth and then live.
Yeah.
How many people in the history of the world have had that experience?
And that's why I'm writing the book, because it's not even about if you're a Monkees fan, it's the man. It is so unique. He goes from being at the height, the pinnacle, the highest you can get as an artist, or, you know, he didn't feel like he was being appreciated as an artist, but in music or in TV, he goes from the top. And what does he do right at the top? He chooses, he buys himself out of that contract and almost goes bankrupt immediately doing it. And then it's like living in a, you know, and then it's bussing tables, really. So it's amazing. It's such a great story. It's fantastic. And it's crazy.
Yep.
Yeah, it's wild.
It's absolutely crazy. And that was this is the exciting thing about your delving into Peter. And you know, one of the things, and one of the reasons why I wanted to talk with you about this, let me ask you something. You're in process of writing. As a writer, are you losing anything by talking about it now while it's in process? Do you gain energy by talking about it? What is your way when you're in the process of writing something like this?
Well, that's a fantastic question. Only another writer or another artist could even form that question. So this is what's so fun about talking with you. But yes, I obsess. I'm an obsessive individual. I'm, you know, an addictive personality. So I'm full throttle. I love talking about this. In fact, this kind of gets some steam off me because I talk nonstop incessantly to everyone I know. And I think everyone's just getting bored of it because, you know, Peter did this. And then Peter did this. Oh, you know, so this is great. No, I love talking. I love talking about it. I could never tire of it. And I love talking about you too. I think, like I said, when I said you're a star, truly, I can't believe I'm talking to you right now. I watched that interview so many times that
that's wonderful.
Wow, you know.
I would like to do a whole episode on the arc of interviewing and the arc of what the etymology was of reasonably spontaneous conversation and why 40 years later we resurrected it, serendipity, and how it's going and what are the differences, because not going to do that, Dennis, because we only have a couple of minutes and I would take the next several hours and we would talk about it, but we'll get it. But anyway, Renee, I just want to tell you that your gift of the work that you've done on yourself and the fascinating, I mean, and I ask anyone, just read her damn bio, the little bio that's on the screen, and you will see just the trails that we're going to be able to go down. But your sincere interest is helping me in a profound way. It is helping me to ground what I'm doing, because what the thing is that whatever you see on the outside, it's always different to the person that's going on the inside.
Yeah.
It's always different. We all have our own challenges. We have our own demons. We have our own. And then we get opportunities along the way to get the kind of lift and encouragement. That's you. And that's
you
in my life. And I knew it. I knew it so clearly when we connected. And this was a light and a gift. And your articulation is extraordinary. I love how you're doing and your curiosity. So we have much to do. We're going to end this program today and at our 30-minute time limit. And then we will pick it up the next time, very soon.
Okay, Dennis. And that was the highest compliment you could have paid me. And I just sling it right back at you. And I'm going to do your biography one day, so just watch out.
We'll talk. All right. Thank you, everyone. And we'll catch you on the next time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.